Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I've been kind of reflecting that at some level we're kind of still, you know, near the beginning of the retreat, even though it's, we're kind of well into the beginning. But another level, I was thinking back when Lumpur took the group off to the Thanksgiving retreat. We kind of really opened up the schedule here, and I think we canceled morning and evening pujas and, you know, really focused on kind of individual practice. And then the entire month of December, we, you know, had half the group on forest practice for that month. And so, you know, for literally like two months now, we've had a really kind of much more open schedule and a lot of emphasis on solitude and practice. So at one level, like we're already halfway into our kind of more relaxed period of the year here. And that kind of brings up a little bit of, say, urgency in me, kind of thinking that the, you know, the retreat's already maybe halfway over in that sense. And the so far, I think the highlight of the retreat for me has been the morning readings, looking at going back and reading, you hear, listening to readings of the Thai masters. And I have to admit, like most mornings, at least at some point during the reading, my body's just been tingling with the piti, with rapture. And this morning when Tanti Tipanyo was reading the story of how Ajahn Mun, or Lungta Mahabua, was a really junior monk, you know, knew that Ajahn Mun was in the same monastery where he was staying, and found out where the alms route was, that Ajahn Mun would go on, and how he sort of planned his whole day because he just wanted to get a chance to see Ajahn Mun. And so he, you know, went out on the alms round early, and then, you know, kind of hid. So he on the someplace along the path where he thought he might be able to see Ajahn Mun. And then, you know, as he saw him, and as he was, you know, reading this account, I have no idea why, but my body was just like vibrating. I almost started crying. It was just, and I have no idea why. It was just this sort of inspiration or faith, or it is something I don't know, and I don't really need to know why, but that was that has been the consequence of a lot of these readings. At some point there's been that kind of faith or joy, just at least anyway, joy and rapture has been arising. One thing that I'm really appreciating about the readings is that they're kind of first-person accounts, you know, they're of very well-practiced monks, and hopefully we'll get into some of the Meichi's readings as well. It's people who've been just very serious practice and have the ability to pass on that knowledge to other people. And so just to hear their first-hand accounts, and, you know, talking about their struggles and what's worked for them, and yeah, I just find that reaches the heart at a different level than, say, in the last period of time. We've a few years anyway, we've been spending a lot of time, you know, reading suttas, which is very valuable and good information. Also can be quite inspiring as well. But I'm just finding for myself that just reading and listening to the Thai masters is just reaching the heart at a different level. this also at the end of the reading this morning, we were had a short discussion about that came up about, say, having visions or dreams, say, asking to see omens. And we don't talk about that very, very much here. And it's probably a good reason for that. It was kind of interesting during the conversation or what I've heard some people, especially in the West, kind of talk about it. That's sort of like, that's not really real or that's not really that important, that kind of aspect of people's experience. And I think maybe a lot of Westerners, don't experience that kind of that kind of attitude or put much significance, to those experiences even if they had them. I was kind of thinking about it in terms of, people, like a lot of my friends, who like when I first discovered Buddhism would, who were not Buddhist would be discussing like, how can you believe such a religion that's so, so full of superstition and, magical stories and stuff like that. And they don't want to put down Christianity. That these people were Christians, and I was thinking of a lot of the stories in Christianity, thinking, seems like a lot of superstition and magic, kind of in those stories as well. So I'm not trying to downplay that, but it's interesting how you can look at, say, Buddhism and or Eastern philosophy and think of it's all kind of magical and not real. But even just in Western cultures, like I was thinking about it this afternoon of. We have our own sort of belief systems that's pretty magical, like that you can get security through insurance, and that you can, find happiness through money and through relationships, and so we have our own superstitions and our own beliefs. For me personally, again, I don't know why, and I don't put too much. Significance to it, or also start off by maybe some of the things I'm going to talk about. I really don't take it personally, or think about it as definitely don't think of it as being special or anything like that. But when I first did start practicing yoga in the beginning, and from that discovered meditation, and kind of in the beginning, I really loved meditation because I didn't have sort of all these sort of mystical things kind of happening to me that did happen when I did yoga practices. And I look back now at kind of like, some of the things that happened when I was doing yoga practices is, maybe it was, like at a psychological level, maybe it, was kind of all created in the mind and none of these things happened. But I can look at it in terms of, maybe my mind sort of, needed these kind of mystical or magical things to happen just to get me interested, to sort of pull me further along the practice. It was things that were, the mind was fascinated with and interested in. And so I was like, well, maybe, maybe it was psychological. Like, none of these things kind of ever happened. And then when I discovered meditation, a lot of these kind of the more mystical kind of things ended. They didn't end completely, and I'll talk about a few that maybe happened when I was since I've been a monk. But was kind of, I think for a while, it's like when I was reading stories of Ajahn Chah or other monks, and I think there's a story of Ajahn Chah where he's on Tudong and. He's in, I think, probably a forest someplace, and he's under his mosquito net and umbrella, and some wild dogs sort of came and started being quite acting aggressive, and I think maybe even sort of like biting at him and kind of being confused because of the mosquito netting. And Ajahn Chah mentions that the story that I heard was that Ajahn Mun comes out of the forest with a fire stick and kind of scares the dogs away. And Ajahn Mun was not there. This wasn't a period of time when Ajahn Chah was living with Ajahn Mun with these, you know, the dogs. Dogs ran away. And so he kind of, you know, so there's that kind of story. I think there's some other places where Ajahn Chah sort of has some, you know, insight into his practice, and you know, he mentions that Ajahn Mun had come to him and given him some teaching, and you know, this is like in his meditation, and you know, got a piece of information, and that developed you know, maybe continued his. Gave a theme for the meditation, and then had some deep insight. You know, when I would read these stories, I would always think, well, that's just, you know, Thai psychology. That was kind of in the back of my mind. There was a sort of belief that, you know, yeah, it was, you know, his practice, you know, developed or matured, and he did have this insight, but just sort of maybe out of deference or out of respect, or, you know, maybe even, you know, he had heard a teaching of Ajahn Mun's, or when he had visited him and, you know, got some instructions, maybe he got a deeper understanding from something he had said at that particular, you know, event, and he maybe had a memory of that, and he was giving, you know, Ajahn Mun, you know, credit out of respect. So that was kind of always in the back of my mind, or the front of my mind, when I would read these stories, was a little bit of skepticism. Not that, you know, Ajahn Chah had these insights, but just his crediting Ajahn Mun. Then during my year in Thailand as a monk, I had this experience where I was traveling with Ajahn Kalyano. It was very near the end of my stay in Thailand for that year, and we had gone down to Bangkok. It was Ajahn Moshe, myself, and Ajahn Kalyano, and we went to a ceremony at one of Ajahn Anand's branch monasteries, and they were doing a Buddha pouring ceremony, and so we were there for the whole afternoon and day, sort of doing chanting and being there for teachings. At the very end of when we were leaving, Ajahn Kalyano had been a kind of a longtime student of Ajahn Anand, and had lived with him for quite a while. And so we got a kind of a private interview with him near the end of the ceremony, right before we left. And so the three of us got to go up and pay respects to him. And then their conversation happened in Thai, so I didn't understand it. But Ajahn Anand was giving Ajahn Kalyano, you know, some instructions and, you know, kind of giving him some advice, because I kind of asked him later what they were talking about, because I was sitting right behind Ajahn Kalyano, and I saw this kind of exchange of Ajahn Anand sort of like, wasn't kind of like, didn't wink at him, but I kind of felt like there was like this transmission had been had been given from Ajahn Anand to Ajahn Kalyano, and it was kind of really, it was kind of interesting, and so... and I, you know, Ajahn Kalyano, I think, did say something like, yeah, he was giving him sort of just encouragement, because he had just started his monastery in Australia, so he was giving him just some encouragement about starting and running the place. And then we went back to Bangkok, and we were staying at this place, Dhammaram, and it happened to be an observance day. And Ajahn Kalyano, though, had some teaching engagements and was off teaching. And I don't do this very often, but that evening, I was just thinking, when I sat down to meditate, I had that vision of that Ajahn Anand, this was sort of the wink, or however he had looked at Ajahn Kalyano, just that, you know, kind of, that came to my mind, into my memory. And so I started my meditation, and I think I'd heard Ajahn Achalo kind of talk about doing this, and so I started my meditation just with the thought that I made it very conscious. I said, you know, if there are any sort of meditation teachers, any masters out there that, you know, can give me some, you know, pointers, or give me some, you know, advice, or you know, can teach me something that would be helpful, that I would need to know, you know, I'm open for that. I'm receptive. So I just started my meditation with that kind of dedication and closed my eyes. And you know, almost immediately I got this image again of Ajahn Anand sitting in the exact same spot there at the ceremony. And in my vision, in my meditation, I reached up and grabbed his feet and started giving him a foot massage. And you know, Ajahn Anand kind of laughed and had me sit down. Then he gave me a Dhamma talk in my meditation. Gave me this Dhamma talk, and there were two parts to it, you know, two completely unrelated kind of teachings, and then there was a third part of it, which was again kind of like this thing about this transmission, which kind of felt like an experience of what he was like. What would it feel like if you had followed what he was teaching? And it was about an hour. This meditation happened, and the whole time was just totally like just I'm sitting here in this room, you know, with Ajahn Anand in front of us giving us a Dhamma talk, and all of a sudden I heard Ajahn Kalyano coming into his room, and we still hadn't done our confession and done the sort of the duties we have to do on the observance days. And so I kind of ended my meditation and went into Ajahn Kalyano's room, and we did our ceremony. And then by that time it was about 11:30 at night, and I asked him, I said, can I tell you about a meditation I just had? And he classically kind of looked down at his watch, and this is the signal of I'm not interested and it's kind of late. And I said, I understand. I said, you know, it's like, I know it's late, and I really want you to be present for when I tell you about this, because I just had a nimitta, a vision of Ajahn Anand. He goes, really? Tell me about it. He was really excited. And so what I found fascinating about this was I started telling him the first part of the first teaching, and I hadn't even finished, you know, I hadn't even gotten very far into the teaching. And Ajahn Kalyano jumped in and explained the rest of it. He said, okay, if that's what he was teaching, this is what he wanted you to know. And sort of explained in more detail that Dhamma talk. And then he went on and told me about the second meditation without me even telling him what that was about. It was a completely different teaching. And I was just kind of like, you don't have any hair, but you know, hair was sort of standing on end in this, again, this feeling of pity like I was having this morning, just sort of, wow, it's pretty amazing. And I kind of attributed that to just, well, he was his student, and you know, if Ajahn Anand was talking about the first part of, you know, this to me, then he, you know, maybe that's just a classical teaching, he would have gone on and taught this other thing. And so I mean, I was, you know, kind of blown away by having this sort of image of Ajahn Anand in my meditation. Well, then the next morning, after we came back from the alms round, and forget exactly the sequence of what happened, but Ajahn Kalyano had been on the phone with Ajahn Anand that morning, and he said, you're going to find this interesting. Ajahn Kalyano, I think he was at the meal, kind of said, I was talking to Ajahn Anand and told him, you know, that I had this vision of him. And he said, Ajahn Anand asked him, you know, what time was it that I had that vision? And he said, well, you know, he had come back about 11:30, and so it must have been around 10 or, you know, 10:30 that I was meditating. He goes, yes, Ajahn Anand said, yes. Last night at about 10 o'clock, I sat down to meditate, and I had the vision of the three of you, Ajahn Kalyano, Ajahn Moshe, and myself, and us paying respects to him. And he said, so I used you as our my meditation, and I was sending you loving kindness at 10 o'clock last night. And so, you know, as soon as he told me that story, again, I started filled with pity and sukha, you know, just knowing that Ajahn Anand had been sending me, you know, loving kindness, sending us loving kindness. But I found it fascinating. Later, I think it kind of hit me that I thought that was quite interesting that, you know, if he was sending loving kindness or using us as an object, that I would receive his loving kindness as wisdom. You know, that he obviously wasn't, you know, sitting there giving me that particular Dhamma talk in his mind. It wasn't like, well, maybe he was. I didn't ask him, but he just, you know, had just mentioned that he was, you know, sending us metta, at that particular time. And so, you know, obviously having that kind of, you know, experience or having that happen, you know, then totally had to start questioning, well, maybe Ajahn, you know, Mun, maybe Ajahn Mun did visit Ajahn Chah and, you know, all these, you know, kind of, you know, I don't know for sure, but I'm much more open and receptive to that, as a possibility. Also, kind of at this, around the same time, this was actually the year that I was in Thailand, so that's what, second or third Pansa. I also, Ajahn Lumpua Plien was always coming to Wat Pananachat at that time, and got to spend a little bit of time with him, not a whole lot, but I started having these, so like this one with that I just told you with Ajahn Anand, that happened, you know, in meditation, so I was, you know, wide awake, and that happened. These other ones happened in dreams, and I had a series of like three or four dreams maybe where Ajahn Lumpua Plien was in my dreams, and I found them fascinating because in the dreams Lumpua Plien was teaching in Thai, and it was always he was talking to me directly. And partly is the first time I had met him, the group was just getting ready to go out from Wat Pananachat. The group was getting ready to go out to Dao Dam, and Lumpua Plien had given the group, you know, some instructions and advice and about going out there. There were some quite fascinating teachings in that, which I won't get into tonight. But at the end of it, he was getting ready to get up off the diem, and he had to, this was, you know, 10, 12 years ago, and the LED flashlights were just becoming kind of popular, were just becoming known, and my parents had just sent me one. And the ex-Ajahn Gunawudo, his mother was visiting Wat Pananachat, and she had given a flashlight, an LED flashlight, to, I forget who it was, but a senior monk had come through, and she had given him her flashlight. And then that night, she had this dream of a monk coming and giving her Dhamma talk. And Ajahn Gunawudo was listening to her and said, "That sounds like Lungta Mahabua, the way he would teach." And so he went and got a book and showed it to her, and had Lungta's photo in it. And she's like, "Yes, that was the monk that came to me in my dream." And so when I saw Lumpua Plien getting up and having this, you know, really old, you know, kind of cheap Thai flashlight, and I just received this flashlight from my parents. They just mailed it to me. And so I immediately jumped up and ran over and gave it to Lumpua Plien. And with actually no, I mean, that was in the back of my mind that you know, the story of Ajahn Gunawudo's mother doing that. But I didn't have that intention in my mind. But I went up and gave him this flashlight. And then he had me sit down in front of the entire Sangha, and he gave me a Dhamma talk in real person, in real life. And not surprising, he gave me a Dhamma talk about light, which Jyoti Palo is protector of light. That's the meaning of the name. He gave me this Dhamma talk on light, and don't really remember too much of it because I was, again, probably filled with pity just sitting there, filled with rapture just receiving these teachings from him. And but then, so I'd say I started having these series of dreams about him later. And in these dreams, again, it would be like he and I would be together, and he was teaching me. I found them fascinating was the fact that he was speaking Thai in the dreams, and I don't speak Thai. But fortunately for me, in my dreams, Ajahn Yanadhamma was there, and he was translating for me in my dreams. And I was his upatak at the time, Hajinyana's upatak. So I would, on the alms round, I'd come back and I'd tell him about these dreams I was having, and I'd thank him for, you know, coming. And I don't think he told me he was doing metta for me that night, but I think he found it fascinating. And but I think every single time I sort of told him about these dreams, and sometimes they were like, one time I remember one of the dreams was pretty minor. It was like there was some sort of minor controversy that was happening in the Sangha at tea time. There was some sort of allowable candy that was being put out, and like half of the monks thought it was not allowable, and half the monks thought it was, and there was this sort of, whoever could get their hands on it first would, send it back to the kitchen, or the other would open it up and pass it out to their friends that, knew that they liked it. And believe it or not, I think I was on the side that felt like it was unallowable. I think I was on that side of the argument, which is kind of surprising. But but I was the more strict view of it. But I had this dream that Ajahn, Nyandama was translating it, but I remember pretty clearly that when I was telling Ajahn Nyandama, about this dream, and I told him, at the time it was just like, a couple hours later, I told him, and so I could remember almost exactly the wording, and we were walking along the road, and Ajahn Nyandama just froze, and he's like, I said, what? And then I, repeated the phrase, and he says, that's quite interesting, because, if I had said that phrase, that means Ajahn, Lumpa Plian would have said this in Thai. And he says, that's really sort of very kind of, unique to his sort of teaching style. And so it's like, that was really Lumpa Plian in your dream, because, for you to know that he to hear him say that and be translated that way. And then he said, it was quite interesting, because then he said, I translated it. That's the way I translate that word, that phrase. But there's other translations of that as well. And so then he started telling me like other ways he could have translated the words, and like everything Ajahn Nyandama told me in real life was equally important to like what I needed to hear, kind of from Lumpa Plian in that teaching. So it was like it's just really fascinating to me. And basically, I think what came out of that particular teaching was, Ajahn Lumpa Plian was telling me that, it's like, with other people in their practice or however they want to practice, it's like, just don't judge other people's practice. It's like, if they want to be strict, that's fine. If they don't want to be strict, that's fine as well. So don't, try, just don't be judgmental of other people's practice. And I've really tried to take that on as a practice. But he said, for me personally, I need to be more, be strict. And that was kind of the gist of that one. And then another, at the same time, I had this really amazing dream where, I don't know why it seems important to me, but I was in the one of the brick kutis in the very back of Wat Bonanichat. There's this little pond out in the back, and I was out in one of those, and I think it just, the setting for me was just, it's a really beautiful kind of secluded place, at least it was back then in the monastery, and was, quite content and really enjoying the practice at that point. And in the dream this night, it wasn't so much a Dhamma talk, but it was a question and answer sort of session I was having with Lumpa Plian. And he was trying to teach me something about concentration practice, and I just wasn't getting it in the dream. I was really kind of, I wouldn't say frustrated, but I kept asking for clarification. I kept asking all these sort of counter questions and really trying to honestly pin him down. But I just remember it was this very lively dialogue going back and forth and not understanding what he was saying, trying to teach me. And then at a certain point, I actually got what he was saying. Like, this major insight sort of kicked in. And again, my whole body just filled with this rapture. And it was so strong, it woke me up, the rapture. And the rapture was actually in the body. It wasn't in the dream. It was in my body. And I sat up and was contemplating this. I was like, running it in my head, forward and backwards, and you know, kind of thinking about even the progress of the questions and like, you know, okay, what was it that actually led to that insight, and kind of contemplating the insight. And it was like 2 or 3 minutes, or maybe even a little bit more than that, that I was, you know, kind of fully aware of what this insight was. And the whole time just sort of, you know, just like shaking with this joy of that insight. And then all of a sudden the thought entered my mind, I should write this down. And as soon as I had that thought, whatever the knowledge was, the insight completely vanished. And I couldn't remember a single thing about it. Like not a single, couldn't remember any of the questions I had asked or, you know, what it was about the insight. And for a split second, there was this like real sadness sort of came over me, like, oh, I've lost it. But then there was this like, you know, other part of the mind sort of kicked in and says, no, it's there. You know, it's like you're not ready yet for, you know, that you're not at the level of practice yet where, you know, that you're going to be able to understand this or, you know, be able to put it into practice yet. But there was this sort of real confidence that when the practice is ripe, when you know, when I put in the proper causes and conditions, that that knowledge is there. You know, it's sort of like I don't necessarily think this way, but well, maybe I do. But it's sort of like at a cellular level, that knowledge is already, that seed. I do believe in that. Like the seed has already been planted for, you know, when that is ready to be ripe, it's going to be there. And I have that real strong confidence in that. So I guess I kind of wanted to, you know, talk about these things a little bit, because we actually, you know, we don't talk about them too much. We don't hear, but I have been around other monks that do talk about, you know, this kind of mystical or kind of esoteric kind of things. But they do, they are, it's kind of amazing how many, you know, people do have these sorts of experiences and might, you know, not take them seriously, or kind of, well, you know, we don't talk about them, so they must not be that important. You know, they might be important, or you can look at it and think, well, okay, that's just delusional. I'm going to, you know, not worry about that. Like even, you know, some of the readings we've done, was it just today? Ajahn Mahabua, or one of the readings we did very recently was the, you know, somebody, one of the monks saying that, you know, they had this dream of, you know, a man in white coming to them. That was today's reading with Ajahn Mahabua, and, you know, saying in, you know, 9 years he was going to, you know, his practice would come to fruition. And that kind of reminded me, Ajahn Thun, whose monastery is right behind us on the ridge of the hill, passed away a few years ago. But he had a very similar experience in his practice where he said he was putting forth just lots and lots and lots of energy, like I think only getting a couple hours of sleep at night. He determined that, I think he was fairly young as a monk, but his meditation was going really well, and he was having lots of kind of insights, and he thought that, you know, okay, I'm gonna put forth, you know, maha, you know, great effort in this retreat, and you know, I might just be able to do this. I might be able to, you know, to crack it, and to become enlightened. And so he was, I think maybe only a couple hours of sleep at night, and he had this vision, this dream of, you know, this man in white coming to him, and this person told him that he was practicing too hard, that he was too much effort. And, you know, when he woke up, I think he had kind of had a very similar attitude of Lung Da Mahabua. It's like, you know, no, I made this determination, you know, I'm going to do this. And he thought, you know, okay, that was, you know, like Mara coming to tempt me, you know, like, you know, see how strong my resolve is. And so, you know, he's going to show this, you know, Mara. He decided he's only going to sleep 1 hour a night. And so he, you know, really, really buckled down on the practice. And then he ended up going into a coma. passed out, went into a coma, and they thought he was dead, and he was not breathing. They couldn't discern a heartbeat, and the abbot of the monastery actually got the funeral pyre, got all the wood gathered, and sent out announcements to all the monks to come, and they were going to do the paritta chanting and funeral chanting, and they went to go get his body to put on the funeral pyre, and they noticed it was still warm. The body was still warm, and at this point it had been like maybe 2 or 3 days, and he still hadn't breathed, hadn't moved, and so they thought, well, wait a second, and they waited, and I think it was like after 6 days or something, he finally came out of the coma, and he said he realized that that person that came to him in his vision was not Mara. it was somebody he should have listened to. And so I forget exactly what happened after that, but I think another kind of related to this kind of topic or thinking about is that one of the things that's come up a lot so far in the readings, is, especially in the beginning, a few readings where there's this real emphasis on looking at knowledge coming from our meditation experience. Looking at where wisdom arises, and in those insights. And a couple of the talks you've read so far have been like to Ajahn Chah talking to scholar monks, and sort of kind of really trying to emphasize going to the meditation practice instead of looking for answers in the book, but looking in the heart. And this is kind of one of the ways I was kind of thinking about this, is that we do put a lot of emphasis in the West on, say, logic or just the intellect and being able to rationalize things in our mind. And I remember this, it's actually a sermon that it wasn't my minister, but the church that I went to when I was growing up. I think I was only like 5 or 6 years old, but I remember this one sermon. And this is how we should actually get the funding, Limpur, for the Dhamma Hall, is that we just need to get one donor to agree to do this. And what the minister had said, this was probably during the children's story thing, but he had all the kids up there, and I was one of them. And he said, okay, now I want you to go home and tell your parents that you're going to do all the chores in the household, like everything, taking out the garbage, doing the breakfast, lunch, and dinner dishes, and vacuuming the house, and you'll do all the chores that have to happen in the house, and you'll do it for one penny for the for a week, and you'll do this for an entire year, but every week you have to double my allowance. He says, you'll be glad you did this. And so if you take one penny, so we did this just with one donor, and just do it every day. So like they give us a penny today, tomorrow they give us 2 pennies and 4 pennies. In just 27 days, that donor will be giving us, I think it's $1.7 million. So if you just double, one penny 27 times, it's $1.7 million. And this also comes up in Bill Bryson's book, History of Nearly Everything. And the image he uses there is as if you take like a phone book, the paper that's in a phone book, that's extremely, extremely thin paper. And the image is if you fold that paper in half, and you fold it, you have two sheets, and you fold that in half. If you fold it over on itself 100 times, if anybody here doesn't know the answer, if you do know the answer, be quiet. But does anybody have a guess of how how thick that piece of paper would be by the time you folded it 100 times? Anybody have a guess? Like, I didn't know this. I guess I remembered that story later of the you know, 27 times being a $1 million. But I remember when we read that in Bill Bryson's, I was thinking, okay, he's got to be, you know, doing some sort of extreme here. So I'm going to guess, you know, like 20 feet, you know, just one piece of paper doubled, you know, 100 times, you know, 20 feet. Well, the distance would be about where Lumpur is sitting to the moon. Just, you know, that stack of paper would be that thick. If you take the penny analogy and you just multiply it out 50 times, it's 6 trillion. So it kind of gives you a sense of $6 trillion. And so I just found this kind of fascinating because, you know, just think, okay, just, you know, doubling a penny 27 times, you know, equals 1.7 million, or just folding a piece of paper over 100 times, that it'd be from here to the moon. It just, the mind can't, you know, we think we're logical. We think, you know, something simple like that, you think you'd be able to wrap your mind around it. But it's one of these things, it's not something that we can comprehend. And there's Lumpur on the Wanpra brought up the experiment of the gorilla sort of walking through the basketball court. And I told Lumpur later, I was like, I was really sad that he used that analogy, because I'd actually been last summer had read a book on that particular subject, and so my mind was racing with all these different psychological experiments that were similar to that, and I didn't hear the rest of his Dhamma talk. But and which is kind of funny, because what that experiment is showing is what's called inattentional blindness is actually the phrase of what that experiment that's showing. And I read about this in a book by this man named Alex Stone, who's a magician, and he's writing about magic, and this is a particular chapter on misdirection, and how magicians use misdirection. And one of the things he points out and say with misdirection is that a lot of people think, like, when someone's doing a card trick or some sort of visual magic, that, you know, the misdirection, sort of like, you know, the puff of smoke or the, you know, loud bang or something like that, is people think that that's there to deceive the eye, to sort of, you know, make people's attention wander someplace, the eye to not see what's happening. But he says what's being misdirected is our attention. It's you're taking your attention away from, you know, watching his hand or her hand to that loud noise. The mind wanders. So it's like the misdirection isn't visual, it's mental. It's the attention. And so he gets into this whole sort of talking about awareness. And a way I was thinking about this with say a really good example of like this misdirection, just missing something, would be like in the morning time, right before the meal, all the monastics are over here in this room to our over here to the side, and we're setting up the bowls, and usually every morning I'm filling the water pitchers, and somebody else, usually during the rest of the year, like, people will be doing breakfast dishes, and, you know, people will be unwrapping the alms bowls and just setting up for the meal. And I've noticed this happen several times. Like, I'll be, you know, just filling my water pitcher and just, you know, noticing if water is spilled on the side of it, and just making a mental note that, okay, I'm going to need to dry that off so it doesn't, you know, fall off or roll down onto the floor in here, and be very, very attentive and 100% sort of present for what I'm doing. And then somebody will say my name, you know, on the other side of the room, and my attention will go completely from that, you know, paying attention 100% to the water pitcher, to who said that, you know, who's talking about me, what did they say? And, you know, my mind will completely be distracted from what I'm doing. And in that moment, Alex Stone sort of points out, is in that moment, like if Ajahn Yaniko and Ajahn Hingsako were trying to play a trick on me, one of them would be on the other side of the room, would mention my name, and then maybe Ajahn Yaniko would be standing behind me. And just in that second that he mentions my name, my attention would completely leave that pitcher of water, and Yaniko could like reach over and put a flower into the water, into the pitcher, and I would not see it, even though my eyes would be completely open and there, because my attention would not be on the visual, it would be completely on the mental. And then, you know, it'd probably just be a second, then I'd realize, oh, you know, I don't need to worry about what they're saying, and then look back at the pitcher, and all of a sudden there'd be this flower there, and be like, what happened? So don't anybody try this tomorrow. But with this experiment of the gorilla walking through the basketball court, Ajahn Pasano got it right. What they do is they have two teams, you know, three players in white jerseys and three players in black, you know, jerseys, and they both have a basketball or some sort of ball, and they're kind of like, you know, chaotically sort of running around this court. They're just not kind of stationary, but they're kind of moving, and so it's kind of chaotic. But the white team is just passing the ball to the white players, and the black players are passing it to themselves. And then you're told that you are to count how many times the white team passes the ball to itself. And then, so this is happening. There's a little, you know, the chaos is happening. And the film is 30 seconds long. And the gorilla is actually on screen for 5 seconds. And in the original, it was a female actor wearing the gorilla suit. She comes on and she stands right in the middle of the court and beats her chest for like 3 or 4 seconds and then walks off. Now they have the experiments. They have these like a camera that will be filming or analyzing the eye, the person who's taking the test, and so they can know exactly where the person's attention is, what they're visually taking in while they're watching this 30-second video. And everybody, you know, almost 100% of the people that watch this video, they all see the gorilla. Their eye is on the gorilla for exactly the same amount of time. They say about 50 to 60% of the people, so it's almost 50-50, 50% of the people will notice the gorilla and 50% won't. But it's 100% of the people actually, it doesn't matter how much time you actually, if you consciously can say, yes, I saw the gorilla, or if you said no, everybody's eye spent exactly 1 second, or roughly 1 second on the gorilla. Some people, you know, could report seeing it, and some people, you know, didn't, 50-50. So it's not that we didn't see the gorilla. It's just that it didn't enter into our consciousness. So it's like, you know, the visual stimulus was there, you know, the light hitting the retina, the going down into the brain stem, you know, going into our brain. So that all happened for everybody. You know, oftentimes this is talked about sort of like in a kind of a negative way, like, well, if you sort of didn't see the gorilla, then you weren't, you know, paying attention, or, you know, in some ways it's like if you did notice the gorilla, you actually weren't following the instructions, because it's like, you know, you were given this, you know, really clear instructions of counting the passes, but, you know, your mind had wandered, and that's why you'd actually, you know, had noticed the gorilla. And so it's when I started, you know, hearing about that experiment, the one thing that really became what I kind of appreciated about that, you know, in a dharmic sense, is that it really shows like the importance of having right view and right intention. So if someone is telling you, you know, I want you to count how many times the basketball's being passed, and if you do that 100% correctly, and you know, your attention is 100% focused on that, you know, you're going to miss the gorilla walking through the room. And so I just saw that as, you know, that's really the importance of having right view, which is, you know, basically, you know, understanding the law of karma and understanding the Four Noble Truths. And so setting that as our, if we set that as where we're going to put our attention, is looking at the Four Noble Truths, then, you know, we are still going to miss the gorilla walking through the room, which is fine. but we will be noticing, you know, dukkha, or we will be, you know, paying attention to what are the causes of dukkha, and paying attention that there is a cessation to it, and in knowing that there's a path. And so really putting our attention on what is important, because there's, like they say, like, you know, like in any given moment, especially like visually, there's, you know, several billion colors in this room right now, you know, just different shades and different colors, and, you know, we cannot be aware of all of them, even though they're there. And it's just learning to put our attention in the right place on the right things. I think the kind of last thing I wanted to, you know, kind of bring up, kind of related to this, is just that, you know, say with the retreat and you know, just where to, you know, where to put our attention is, I'm not sure exactly how this is related or how I'm going to relate it, but this is one of the things I was hoping to talk about a little bit, was that, again, I've been listening to a little bit of Ajahn Sona, and he was bringing up in one of his introductory talks to, say, a 10-day retreat, he's just really encouraging, you know, like the people at the retreat that, you know, especially as they start the retreat, and then just sort of encourages people to come back to it every day, and just really set this intention that, you know, when you do, you have that, the view or the intention to, you know, be using a particular meditation object, you know, it's like, he brought up the interesting point that you know, it's like most of what we're going to be experiencing during the retreat is, it's results of past karma. So, like, you know, we're going to be sitting down, you know, with the intention to focus, focus on the breath, or to be, you know, developing some type of meditation. But, you know, what's going to come up might be aversion, might be tiredness, might be, you know, aversion. You know, we have all sorts of other things are going to come up, and that's more, you know, he points out is the results of past actions. It has nothing to do with the, you know, what your intention in meditating is today. And so one thing is to look at it as, you know, what we use as a meditation object is to, is we're planting seeds. So we're planting the intention, we're planting planting causes for, say, more, you know, peace, more insights, more, you know, the wisdom to arise in the future, which kind of relates back to what I was talking about with some of the, you know, the visions that I was having, or, you know, the piti and sukha coming up from listening to Dhamma talks, because I really do think that's, you know, it's resultant of things that probably have happened in the past, and can't know that for sure, but I have a suspicion it's probably related. But also then, you know, sort of, you know, realizing that, you know, that is what we're doing is, you know, we are creating the causes for, you know, happiness here in the present moment as well as into the future. So really taking that, being very cautious kind of with that as well, because we're also potentially planting seeds for the negative mind states. So like when we do sit down to meditate, and, you know, if there's pain in the body or boredom comes up, you know, like how we respond to that, you know, we're going to be conditioning ourselves to having those, you know, however we, whatever tools we use to try to overcome that, you know, we'll be reinforcing that. So if we, you know, go into fantasy or, you know, put up a, you know, physical resistance and you know, just any kind of unskillful way of trying to, you know, almost like trying to force time to hurry up, like, you know, when's the bell going to ring, and just sort of, you know, anxious and worry, you know, those will be, you know, future conditions that'll make it easier for us to react that way in the future. And so a lot of use this phrase, which I really loved, is re-mindfulness, thinking of it in terms of, you know, just being mindful and just, you know, coming back to that over and over again, like, and using the definition of mindfulness as you know, bringing, it's not just sort of like being aware of, like, say, being aware of your breath or just being mindful of the physical sensations in the body, but being mindful of the teachings that we've heard, all the different, you know, so that's what the, when we've been doing the readings of the Thai monks, I think one of the things that has been bringing me a lot of joy is, you know, hearing a lot of these, you know, teachings that I've, you know, started, you know, with when I first started meditating, and just getting this reminder again of, oh yeah, these are the teachings that really attracted me when I first started meditating, and haven't necessarily, you know, read a lot of these teachings in the last, you know, quite a long time since I've heard some of these teachings. And so it's just this reminder of, oh yeah, there's, you know, that is in the back of my mind, or that is there. And so it's a lot of this re-mindfulness is to, when you're sitting down to meditate, it's not just being aware of the body and being aware of your breath, but it's to remember that when you do have a hindrance come up, there are tools. You know, there are, and so when you're listening to the Dhamma talks and the readings, to, you know, really pay attention to, you know, like, well, how does Lungta Mahobua, you know, advise to deal with these hindrances, or, you know, what is Ajahn Chah, or some of the tactics that he used. And then as you're meditating and you do come across these hindrances, you know, it's just remembering, okay, there are tools, you know, and it's not sort of like memorizing, okay, I need to do, when this hindrance comes up, I need to do this. But it's a lot of it can just be that, okay, when this, you know, when a hindrance comes up, okay, just having that knowledge that, okay, there's tools to work with, there's ways to experiment. You know, I'll try, you know, what Ajahn Mahabua said and see if that works. But if it doesn't, then, you know, I'll try something else. But just remembering that there are these tools. And I had this really nice experience where, and this came actually from Ajahn Sona, whereas I was sitting and I noticed this, you know, a lot of physical pain in the sit. This was just a couple of days ago. And I saw the mind just want to, you're starting really to complain and you know, creating unwholesome mind states. And I remembered from Ajahn Sona this teaching he had given, where he was talking about, you know, if you want to be peaceful, you know, if you know, that's really kind of the you know, the goal is having a peaceful mind. He just used the phrase, he says, you know, it's like, are you the kind of person that peace would want to come and hang out with? And, you know, as soon as I remembered that teaching, it was just like, you know, the whole, you know, drama, what was going on in my head just completely dropped. Because I could think, I can completely see that it's like, yeah, I mean, if I'm sitting here with an angry mind, an averse mind, a mind that's pushing away, it's like, yeah, that's not peace. That's, you know, it's not... even in itself, it's not peace, but it's also like, I just like this image of kind of seeing it as something external, even though it's peace comes from the mind, but seeing it as something external is like, yeah, would, you know, like, if you want people to like you, you know, it's like, is it going to happen because you're yelling at them? Is it going to happen because you're sort of, you know, forcing it to do what you want it to do? And so sort of seeing the mind in the same way, the sort of, you know, if I want this mind to be peaceful, if I want it to be happy, then you know, is what I'm doing, in the meditation right now, is that fostering that? Is it going to be possible by the conditions that I'm putting into the meditation right now? Well, I realized I've talked for quite a bit tonight, and I'm keeping us all from going back and having dreams, and hopefully you'll have dreams of Krupa Ajahn's coming and giving you further Dhamma talks tonight. So it's been a little bit of a different kind of Dhamma talk tonight, so if I've said anything that resonates with you and encourages your practice, then please use that. And if it's something that you're skeptical about, then Zajin Amar would always say, then just set that aside. So I offer that for reflection.
Uh-huh.